I'm Christopher Lydon. Welcome back to my living room. Help yourself to wine, nuts, and cheese, if you will. We're reading Chekhov stories again with a crew of actors, schoolteachers, and friends, learning as we go. The story this time is called Dreams. It's a dense 7-page fantasy of the good life in the far wilds of eastern Siberia. It's a dream of freedom that pops full-blown, sharply detailed, from the head and heart of an enfeebled, red-nosed tramp who's being muscled along by two soldiers. It's part of the plot, in a story that has no plot, really, that this dream has a reality all its own. When spoken aloud, the dream is a life force that quickly envelops the two soldiers and perhaps the rest of us as we listen. We'll see. We're learning also the explicit influence that the great Chekhov had on storytellers ever since. Anton Chekhov, medical doctor, playwright, born in Russia in 1860, the son of a liberated serf. He died young of tuberculosis in 1904 and has been credited ever after as the father of the modern short story. It'll be clear, I think, that Samuel Beckett and Ernest Hemingway both took a thing or two from this story, Dreams. I'll be passing the book along to four other readers. We also have a sort of Greek chorus of friends who are invited to interrupt with stray thoughts anytime. It's part of the fun with Chekhov to digress as the spirit moves any of us. First, I'll ask the four readers to tell us who they are, and then I'll kick off the story, Dreams.
Hello, I'm Niaz Yousoufi. I am an Emerson graduate and an actor.
Hi, I'm Sarah Barton. I am librarian by day, actress by night.
I'm Ken Cheeseman. I'm an actor and I'm an artist in residence at Emerson College.
And I'm Elizabeth Albritton, and I teach English as a second language in the public schools in Needham.
Two soldiers are escorting to the county seat a vagrant who refuses to give his name. One of them is black-bearded and thick-set, with legs so uncommonly short that, seen from behind, they seem to begin much lower down than those of other men. You've seen backsides like that. The other is long, lank, spare, and straight as a stick, with a thin beard of dark reddish hue. The first waddles along, looking from side to side and sucking now a straw and now the sleeve of his coat. He slaps his thigh and hums to himself and looks, on the whole, light-hearted and carefree. The other, with his lean face and narrow shoulders, is staid and important-looking. In build and in the expression of his whole person, he resembles a priest of the old believers, or one of those warriors depicted on antique icons. For his wisdom, God has enlarged his brow, that is to say. He is bald, which still more enhances the resemblance. The first soldier is called Andrei Ptaka, the second Nikander Sapozhnikov. The man they are escorting is not in the least like what everyone imagines a tramp should be. He is small and sickly and feeble, with little, colorless, absolutely undefined features. His eyebrows are thin, his glance is humble and mild, and his whiskers have barely made their appearance, though he is already past 30. He steps timidly along, stooping, with his hands thrust into his sleeves. The collar of his threadbare, unpeasant-like little coat is turned right up to the brim of his cap, so that all that can venture to peep out at the world is his little red nose. When he speaks, it is in a high, obsequious little voice, and then he immediately coughs. It is hard, very hard, to recognize in him a vagabond who is hiding his name. He looks more like some impoverished, godforsaken son of a priest, or a clerk discharged for intemperance, or a merchant's son who has essayed his puny strength on the stage and is now returning to his home to play out the last act of the parable of the prodigal son. Perhaps, judging from the dull patience with which he battles with the clinging autumn mud, he is a fanatic, some youth trained for a monk who is wandering from one monastery to another all over Russia, doggedly seeking a life of peace and freedom from sin, which he cannot find. Sarah.
The wayfarers have been walking a long time, but for all their efforts, they cannot get away from the same spot of ground. Before them lie 10 yards of dark brown muddy road. Behind them lies as much. Beyond that, wherever they turn, rises a dense wall of white fog. They walk and walk, but the ground they walk on is always the same. The wall comes no nearer, the spot remains a spot. Now and then they catch glimpses of white irregular cobblestones, a dip in the road, or an armful of hay dropped by some passing wagon. A large pool of muddy water gleams for a moment, or a shadow, vaguely outlined, suddenly and unexpectedly appears before them. The nearer they come to this, the smaller and darker it grows. They come nearer still, and before them rises a crooked milepost with its numbers effaced, or a woebegone birch tree, naked and wet, like a wayside beggar. The birch tree is whispering something with the remains of its yellow foliage. One leaf breaks off and flutters sluggishly to the ground, and then again there comes fog and mud and the brown grass by the roadside. Dim, evil tears hang on these blades. Not the tears of quiet joy that the earth weeps when she meets and accompanies the summer sun, and with which at dawn she quenches the thirst of quail and rails and graceful long-billed snipe. The feet of the travelers are caught by the thick, sticky mud. Every step costs them an effort. Andrei Pitaka is a trifle provoked. He is scrutinizing the vagrant and trying to understand how a live, sober man could forget his name. "You belong to the Orthodox Church, don't you?" he asks. "I do," answers the tramp briefly. "Have you been christened?" "Of course I have. I'm not a Turk. I go to church and observe the fasts and don't eat meat when it's forbidden to do so." "Well, then what name shall I call you by?" "Call me what you please, lad." Pitaka shrugs his shoulders and slaps his thigh in extreme perplexity. The other soldier, Nikander, preserves a sedate silence. He is not so simple as Pitaka, and evidently knows very well reasons which might induce a member of the Orthodox Church to conceal his identity. His expressive face is stern and cold. He walks apart and disdains idle gossip with his companions. He seems to be endeavoring to show to everyone and everything, even to the mist, how grave and sensible he is. "The Lord only knows what to think about you," pursues Pitaka. "Are you a peasant or not? Are you a gentleman or not? Or are you something between the two? I was rinsing out a sieve in a pond one day and caught a little monster as long as my finger here, with gills and a tail. Thinks I, it's a fish! Then I take another look at it, and I'll be blessed if it didn't have feet. It wasn't a fish, and it wasn't a reptile. The devil only knows what it was. That's just what you are. What class do you belong to?"
Ken, before you plunge, it seems very obvious, but I may be crazy. What does this suggest? To me, it's Waiting for Godot. It is exactly the stage scene of Godot, two men escorting a mystery, shall we say, and we don't know what, but they're wandering, going nowhere, hitting a wall, even including that lonely birch tree with the one leaf hanging. You wonder, did not Beckett pick up a stage scene right here?
It feels possible, and it's so funny because just in class today, I just gave out a little clip of Waiting for Godot to my freshman.
Ian McKellen?
I just gave them a little clip of it to try to make sense of and to exist in for a little while. And it's just such a great world to drop into because it is the existential dilemma in that you've got to identify everything and yet nothing is identifiable. It's a drop into the don't know. And that's right where he's got us with this story. Same thing.
Carry on, bro.
All right. "I am a peasant by birth," sighs the tramp. "My mother was a house serf. In looks I'm not a peasant, and that is because fate has willed it so, good man. My mother was a nurse in a gentleman's house and had every pleasure the heart could desire, and I, as her flesh and blood, belonged in her lifetime to the household. They petted me and spoiled me and beat me till they beat me from common to well-bred. I slept in a bed, had a real dinner every day, and wore trousers and low shoes like any little noble. Whatever my mother had to eat, I had. They gave her dresses and dressed me too. Oh, we lived well. The candy and cake I ate in my childhood would buy a good horse now if I could sell them. My mother taught me to read and write, and from the time I was a baby instilled the fear of God into me and trained me so well that to this day I couldn't use an impolite peasant word. I don't drink vodka, lad, and I dress cleanly and can make a respectable appearance in good society. God give her health if she is still alive. If she is dead, take her soul. Oh, Lord, to rest in thy heavenly kingdom where the blessed find peace. The tramp uncovers his head with its sparse bristles, casts his eyes upwards, and makes the sign of the cross twice. Give her peace, O Lord, in green places, he says in a drawling voice more like an old woman's than a man's. Keep thy slave, Kenya, in all thy ways, O Lord. If it had not been for my good mother, I should never have been a simple peasant now, not knowing a thing. As it is, lad, ask me what you please. I know everything. The Holy Scriptures, all godly things, all the prayers and the catechisms. I live according to the Scriptures. I do wrong to no one. I keep my body pure. I observe the fasts and eat as it is ordered. Some men find pleasure only in vodka and brawling, but when I have time, I sit in a corner and read a book. And as I read, I cry and cry. Why do you cry? Because the things they tell of are so pitiful. Sometimes you pay only 5 kopecks for a book and weep and wail over it to despair. Is your father dead? Asked Taka. I don't know, lad. It's no use hiding a sin. I don't know who my father was. What I think is that I was an illegitimate son of my mother's. My mother lived all her life with the gentry and never would marry a common peasant. So she flew higher up to his master, laughed Stotka. That is so. My mother was pious and godly, and of course it is a sin, a great sin to say so, but nevertheless, maybe I have noble blood in my veins. Maybe I am a peasant in station only, and am really a high-born gentleman.
The high-born gentleman utters all this with a soft, sickly sweet voice, wrinkling his narrow brows and emitting squeaky noises from his cold, red little nose. Taka listens to him, eyes him with astonishment, and still shrugs his shoulders. After going 4 miles, the soldiers and the tramp sit down on a little knoll to rest. Even a dog can remember his name, mutters Taka. I am called Andre, and he is called Nicander. Every man has his God-given name, and no one could possibly forget it. Not possibly. Whose business is it of anyone's to know who I am? Sighs the tramp, leaning his cheek on his hand. And what good would it do me if they knew? If I were allowed to go wherever I liked, I should be worse off than I am now. I know the law, my Christian friends. Now I'm a vagrant who does not remember his name. And the worst they could do to me would be to send me to Eastern Siberia with 30 or 40 lashes. But if I should tell them my real name and station, I should be sent to hard labor again, I know. You mean to say you've been a convict? I have, my good friend. My head was shaved, and I wore chains for 4 years. What for? For murder, good man. When I was still a boy, about 18 years old, my mother put arsenic into our master's glass by mistake instead of soda. There were a great many different little boxes in the storeroom, and it was not hard to mistake them. The tramp sighs, shakes his head, and continues. She was a godly woman, but who can say? The soul of another is a dark forest. Maybe she did it by mistake. Maybe it was because her master had attached another servant to himself, and her heart could not forgive the insult. Perhaps she did put it in on purpose. God only knows. I was young then and couldn't understand everything. I remember now that our master did, in fact, take another mistress at that time, and that my mother was deeply hurt. Our trial went on for 2 years after that. My mother was condemned to 20 years penal servitude, and I to 7 on account of my youth. At what charge were you convicted on? For being an accomplice, I handed our master the glass. It was always that way. My mother would prepare the soda, and I would hand him the glass. But I am confessing all this before you, brothers, as before God. You won't tell anyone. No one will ever ask us, said Taka. So that means you ran away from prison, does it? Yes, I ran away, good friend. 14 of us escaped. God be with them. They ran away and took me along, too. Now judge for yourself, lad, and tell me honestly whether I have any reason for telling my name. I should be condemned to penal servitude again. What sort of a convict am I? I'm delicate and sickly. I like cleanliness in my food and in the places where I sleep. When I pray to God, I like to have a little shrine lamp or a candle burning, and I don't like to have noises going on round me when I'm praying. When I prostrate myself, I don't like to have the floor all filthy and spat over, and I prostrate myself 40 times, morning and night, for my mother's salvation. The tramp takes off his cap and crosses himself. But let them send me to Eastern Siberia if they want to, he cries. I'm not afraid of that. What, is that better? It is an entirely different affair. At hard labor, you are no better off than a crab in a basket. You are crowded and pushed and hustled. There's not a quiet corner to take breath. It's a hell on earth. The mother of God forbid it. A ruffian you are, and a ruffian's treatment you receive, worse than any dog's. You get nothing to eat. There's nowhere to sleep, and nowhere to say your prayers. In exile, it's different. You first enroll yourself in the company, as everyone else does. The government is compelled by law to give you your share of land. Yes, indeed. Land, they say, is cheap there, as cheap as snow. You can take all you want. They would give me land for farming, lad, and land for a garden, and land for a house. Then I would plow and sow, as other men do, raise cattle and bees and sheep and dogs. I'd get myself a Siberian cat to keep the rats and mice from eating my property. I'd build me a house, brothers, and buy icons. And God willing, I'd marry and have children.
Hold it there just for a second. What started as this kind of existential mystery has taken on a lot of baggage and flesh. He says he's the illegitimate child of a rich man by his mistress. He helped his mother kill the old man. He's a convict. He doesn't say his name. This is a homeless man on the streets of New York, and he's been pulled over. But if he gives his name, he goes back to penal servitude. Something's up here, but I just wonder, what layers of this sort of waiting for Godot mystery can we unpeel?
I've never heard Siberia described in such a pot. I'm like, this sounds good.
Right.
Cat, house, bees.
Maybe children, maybe a great estate.
All along, this whole time.
Eastern Siberia.
Okay.
So who is he? Who is Godot here?
Well, that's like part of it. I think there's this whole theme of dehumanization. You know, he felt like a crab in this labor camp, and now he's lost his name, which is, you know, what makes you yourself. So that theme is running through.
But he has his story.
Yeah.
Again, the dog. Even a dog can remember his name. Mm-hmm. Any notion where we're going? Is it still a kind of Godot picture or not?
Seems like it got real all of a sudden. Like, there was a crime, there was imprisonment.
Right.
He has a history.
Maybe he's a noble man, maybe he's a poor peasant. There's a lot of class thing.
And again, we have the mother drilling her son, like, my boy is going to have a higher station in life than I did.
Yeah. Okay, Nyazi, over to you.
The tramp is murmuring to himself now and has ceased looking at his listeners. He's gazing off somewhere to one side. Artless as his reveries are, he speaks with such sincerity and such heartfelt earnestness that it is hard not to believe what he says. The little mouth of the Virgin is twisted by a smile, and his whole face, his eyes, and his nose are numbed and paralyzed by the foretaste of far-off happiness. The soldiers listen and regard him earnestly, not without compassion. They also believe what he says. I'm not afraid of Siberia, the tramp murmurs on. Siberia and Russia are the same thing. They have the same God there as here, and the same czar, and they speak the language of Orthodox Christian. As I am speaking with you, only there is a greater plenty, and the people are richer. Everything is better. Take, for example, the river. They're 1,000 times finer than ours. And fish. Fishing in them is simply beyond words. Fishing, brothers, is the greatest joy of my life. I don't ask for bread, only let me sit and hold a fishing line. Indeed, that is true. I catch fish on a hook and line and in pots and with bow nets. And when the ice comes, I use cast nets. I'm not strong enough to fish with a cast net myself, so I have to hire a peasant for 5 kopecks to do that for me. Heaven, what fun it is. It's like seeing your own brother again.
to catch an eel or a mudfish, and you have to treat every fish differently. I can tell you, you use a minnow for one and a worm for another, and frog or a grasshopper for a third. You've got to know all that. Take, for example, the eel. The eel isn't a dainty fish. It will take even a newt. Pikes, like earthworms, carfish, butterflies. There is no greater joy on earth than fishing for chubs in a swift water. You bait your hook with a butterfly or a beetle so that it will float on the surface, and you let your line run out some 20 or 30 yards without a sinker. Then you stand in the water without your trousers and let the bait flow down with a current tilt, tuck, and there's a chub on the hook. Then you have to watch ever so closely for just the right moment to hook it, or the confounded thing will go off with your bait. The moment it twitches the lines, you've got to pull. There isn't a second to lose. The number of fish I have caught in my life is a caution. When we were escaping and the other convicts were asleep in the forest, I couldn't sleep and I would go off in search of a river. The rivers there are so wide and swift and steep bank. It's a caution. And all along their shores lies dense forests. The trees are so high that it makes your head swim to look up to the top of them. According to prices here, every one of those pine trees is worth 10 rubles.
I mean, aren't we suddenly in Hemingway fishing territory? I mean, we're in northern Michigan. Young Hemingway is the master of the line.
But that's also, in a way, the Godot. Because fishing is about waiting. Yeah. You know, fishing is about having the patience to wait and wait and wait. And sometimes not get anything.
Yeah.
And come back the next day and fish again. And
a bad day fishing is better than a good day doing anything else, right?
Yes, that's right. It's still that dilemma of waiting and waiting and waiting and not knowing what you're going to pull up. But the exciting thing he says is you don't know what you're going to pull up. Yeah. It might be an eel, it might be a chub, it might be a pike, it might be anything.
But he knows who likes what bait. I mean, this is a very accomplished, convincing, persuasive fisherman.
And it's like seeing your own brother again to catch an eel.
Yes.
There was also this, you know, from the religious context, the idea that he who believes is patient. And I think he found that patience in his religion. I mean, he says that he's a very devout Christian and, you know, he knows the Bible very well. So I think this notion of patience is brought forth.
Mm. The night of faith. Kierkegaard's night of faith. Yeah. You give up all hope, but you wait anyway.
Exactly.
So do we know where we're going? Any guess?
Well, are we wondering if he's going to identify himself?
I don't think he will. Do you
Can they force him?
Do they want to?
It's not like they care too much.
They like him, though, right?
And they believe him. They're liking him more and more, I think.
Yeah.
And he's earnest, they're earnest. Everybody's sort of holding their breath here. Let me continue, and then I'll pass it to Ken. Under the confused stress of his imagination, the dream pictures of the past and the sweet foretaste of happiness, the piteous little man stops speaking and only moves his lips as if whispering to himself. The feeble, beatific smile does not leave his face. The soldiers say nothing. Their heads have sunk forward onto their breasts, and they are lost in meditation. In the autumn silence, when a chill, harsh fog from the earth settles on the soul and rises like a prison wall before one to testify to the narrow limits of man's freedom, then it is sweet to dream of wide, swift rivers with bold, fertile banks, of dense forests, of boundless plains. Idly, peacefully, the fancy pictures to itself a man, a tiny speck, appearing on the steep, uninhabited bank of a river in the early morning before the flush of dawn has faded from the sky. The summits of the everlasting pines rise piled high in terraces on either side of the stream, and muttering darkly, look sternly at that free man. Roots, great rocks, and thorny bushes obstruct his path, but he is strong of body and valiant of heart and fears neither the pines nor the rocks nor the solitude nor the rolling echoes that reiterate every footfall. Ken.
The imagination of the soldiers is painting for them pictures of a free life which they have never lived. Is it that they darkly recall images of things heard long ago? Or have these visions of a life of liberty come down to them with their flesh and blood as an inheritance from their remote, wild ancestors? God only knows. The first to break the silence is Nicander, who until now has not let fall a word. Perhaps he's jealous of the vagrant's visionary happiness. Perhaps he feels in his heart that dreams of bliss are incongruous amidst surroundings of gray mist and brown-black mud. At any rate, he looks sternly at the tramp and says, "That is all very well, brother. That is all very fine. But you'll never reach that land of plenty. How could you? You could go 30 miles and then give up the ghost, a little half-dead creature like you. You've only walked 4 miles today, and yet look at you. You can't seem to get rested at all." The tramp turns slowly to Nicander, and the blissful smile fades from his face. He looks with dismay at the grave countenance of the soldier, as if he had been caught doing wrong, and seems to have recollected something, for he nods his head. Silence falls once more. All three are busy with their own thoughts. The soldiers are trying to force their minds to grasp what perhaps God alone can conceive of the terrible expanse that lies between them and that land of freedom. Images more clear, precise, and terrifying are crowding into the vagrant's head. Courts of justice, dungeons for exiles and for convicts, prison barracks, weary halts along the road, the cold of winter, illness, the death of his companions, all rise vividly before him. The tramp blinks, and little drops stand out upon his brow. He wipes his forehead with his sleeve, draws a deep breath as if he had just jumped out of a hot oven, wipes his forehead with the other sleeve, and glances fearfully behind him. "It is quite true that you could never get there," Taka assents. "You're not a walker. Look at yourself, all skin and bone. It would kill you, brother." "Of course it would kill him. He couldn't possibly do it," declares Nicander. "He'll be sent straight to the hospital anyway, as it is. That's a fact." The nameless wanderer looks with terror at the stern, impassive faces of his evil-boding fellow travelers. Then, lowering his eyes, he rapidly crosses himself without taking off his cap. He is trembling all over. His head is shaking, and he is beginning to writhe like a caterpillar that someone has stepped on. "Come on! Time to go," cries Nicandrus, rising. "We've rested long enough." Another minute, and the travelers are plodding along the muddy road. The tramp is stooping more than before, and has thrust his hand still deeper into the sleeves of his coat. Taka is silent. 1886.
What is that about? His imagination of freedom, which totally takes over the minds of those soldiers.
And the story, yeah.
It's funny because we were asking about inspirations that other authors maybe have found in Chekhov. I'm not sure, like, if these things that I see are just parallels or whether they're inspirations. I'd have to find out, but Kurosawa has a film called Dreams, and it's like little short stories. There's one that's very compelling and almost apocalypse-like and very despairing, some of them are at times, and then they find their way out of it. And there's another one where a man walks into a Vincent van Gogh painting and finds Van Gogh in a field painting, and it's Martin Scorsese playing Van Gogh. But it's very similar in this reaching, this longing that we have in dreams. And it wasn't until the final few paragraphs that I went back to the title of the short story, which is Dreams. Suddenly I was like, oh,
yeah,
it's all like a dream.
There's one moment, if I'm not mistaken, where it's the landscape that is sort of conjuring up the man. It's the banks, the freedom of the river, the wildness of, I guess, Siberia, that is sort of inventing this whole story. Nazi, you had that wonderful exposition of his fantasy, like seeing his brother again. Can I just say parenthetically, one of the beauties of reading this stuff aloud is that your eye would pass right over almost all of the value here if you were reading it in a library or in a chair, I think, silently. I don't know. How does that vagrant, that victim, that poor, pathetic no-name take over the minds of those other men?
At first, I felt like they finally got to him. They just told him, listen, you're a dream, you're delusional, your life sucks, that nothing that you're saying is ever going to happen. Just give up. Pretty much almost like maybe their own subconscious, like we've given up.
You can't even walk.
Yeah, like
4 miles.
Just
they're
forget
talking
it.
Themselves. Yeah,
yeah, but then you mentioned that he has this, he writhes towards the end. He almost feels like he shakes it off, that nothing can really ruin his hope. And he's going to just continue to stumble along, regardless of how bad it is, you know?
But it's such a sustaining thing, and I think probably for most of us, in some ways, this is how much of your brain is occupied by either an imagined future or an imagined past, in some ways, because we don't necessarily believe that this guy is the greatest fisherman. You know, there were fishermen, fish leaping out of the river every time he... But, you know, it has nothing to do with the present or even with the real possibility or reality, yeah. But just that it's so gripping.
Yeah.
You know, this image of this homestead in eastern Siberia or this forest and this river and this, you know, remembered but enhanced kind of abundance and beauty.
What's the Siberian version of all this? Dina?
You know, it's interesting because when I hear this story, of course I have like the whole chain of association in my head, you know, from childhood, from my life. That when I hear you guys talk, it's a completely different chain of association, you know. So it's very interesting to compare. I don't know what actually to say. I think the image of bright future was very big for Russia anyway, because the presence is always gloomy, or you look at it as a very gloomy thing. And I was just actually thinking that, you know, Rachmaninoff, who lived at the same time, he had two romances which called Dreams. And actually, if you listen to Russian music, there's like this dreamy element. It's like not about present, it's about imaginary world.
So yeah, I love Sarah's point about he's this momentary midpoint between an imagined past or a completely uncertain past. You name it, whatever. Where did he come from? And this uncertain future, complete mystery, and he's fabricating it all. Dina, though, you raise an interesting point. I keep wondering, what is the music of these stories? Rachmaninoff was almost a contemporary, Tchaikovsky very much a contemporary, and a friend, and lots of others. What is the musical sound? What is the theme music under this roaring stream?
Actually, the music of this period is so unbelievably beautiful, you know, so I think it has this element of just unattainable beauty, you know, and dreamy world. But I don't think they can think they have achieved it, you know. I think this kind of hopeless quality, at least it's what I think about.
But just forgive me for being too literal, but is it a hopeless ending? The vagrant is stooping lower and his hands deeper into his pockets at the end, and they're bombarding him with his terrible situation. He's sickly, he can't make it, he'd never get to Siberia in the first place. But is he defeated or not? I wonder.
Oh, no, they haven't destroyed his imagination, his alternative world that he must have.
Spell it out.
That's why the ending seems so totally modern. You're talking about who's influenced by this. James Joyce.
Right.
You think, well, did he invent the modern short story? Hell no. He read Chekhov wrote The Dubliners. But this end that you think it isn't an end, but it is an end because the imagination is endless in that story. I don't think he's defeated at the end.
I don't think
the soldiers want to defeat him.
First, I thought
they're going to beat hell out of him.
What about the fact that Chekhov takes over the ending? Right? Mm-hmm. It's no longer... the tramp
talking, but it becomes this sort of authorial voice that comes in,
mm-hmm.
right? And mm-hmm. I'm always wondering, like, you know, who is Chekhov allied with? You know, for a long time he has me thinking, oh, Chekhov is with the tramp here, right? But then he just actually disavows it. It seems to me like takes over the story and gives us this landscape, and which makes me curious about the Siberian landscape, right? Is it the kind of landscape that inspires kind of like this non-committal flirtation with the supernatural sort of, right? I'm just wondering, like, what is Chekhov like trying to sort of think about in this space? Because he is having this dalliance with the cloth of religion, right? He's playing with it. It seems to me mocking it. And almost in a godlike fashion, he takes over the end of the story, right? He comes in and sort of gives you the great wrap up.
What feels right? like yeah. By coming in at the end, he's showing that the vagrant has shut off. These guys are beyond hope. If all they can see is my wasted body, then what's the point of talking to them? What's the point of telling them how beautiful it is in my mind if they can't connect? I don't know. It feels like he by taking over at the end, Chekhov has said, like, well, he's turned these guys off. He's gone back. He's just walking.
So many Chekhov stories end formally unresolved, and we'll read these love stories. There are lots of them actually in which it basically be. Comes a question of should I leave or should I stay, and is this a hopeless relationship or not? But it seems to me in this case, which is quite unresolved, I love your line, Luke, that this, of course, the imagination is the driving character here, and of course the imagination prevails. He can't be defeated.
Or is the title ironic? Dreams.
Dreams. It sounds to me like that incredibly all-encompassing Dostoevsky story called The Dream of a Ridiculous Man, who dreams that he is captured by aliens, taken to another planet, shown a beautiful way to live, and he comes back to preach the gospel, basically. Treat people as you would be treated. And people stop him on the street and say, you're just dreaming. You just had a dream. And he says, your reality made me want to kill myself. It was my dream that made me want to live. So the dream wins. Of course the dream has to win.
I mean, he's not desperately curious to know a kind of truth about it. You know, he's got this, you know, I don't know whether I could be a peasant. I could be a of noble birth. My mother, she might have murdered him. She might not. I'm not really sure. You know, he's not trying to find like a hard truth of his life or his.
Interesting.
You know, his mother.
He is a man who's defined by his hopes and not his fears. No, I'm just actually quoting Obama on Mandela's funeral. But I lived through a war, and
which war?
The Yugoslav war of the late '90s, and even then, one thing that we had, regardless of our situation, all we had was our hopes and dreams, you know. And if we had given up on that, then it meant that we're dead. We might as well just be dead. Viktor Frankl has an incredible book called "Man's Search for Meaning," where he creates a world that he lived through the Holocaust. He was sent to concentration camps, and the first signs that people were demonstrating when they would give up would be, you know, they would start smoking, and subsequently they would either run to grab the electrical fence or they would just try to escape, and the Nazis would shoot them. So then he creates this notion of, regardless to how bad your current times are, and how awful it may seem, there's still hope for the future, you know. And I think that's the theme here, that, you know, Chekhov's trying to say that, you know. You know, it might be Siberia, it's cold, and don't worry about these other two guys. You live in your world and keep hope and keep living, keep dreaming, because that's the only thing that you have. And well, that's the choice that only you can make, I guess.
No, and a fear, essentially, the fears we all live with, that he's living with, these scenarios the soldiers are painting, are really only other imaginations. They're really, really only darker,
yeah.
or darker dreams of something that may or may not happen. Mm-hmm. And yet you think of all the things that, you know, crack your head,
yeah.
all the...
Last call. What do we learn about Chekhov himself here, other than that it was nonsense that he wrote these stories quickly, batted them off in a day, or that they were innocent or somehow naive little narratives?
There's a kind of ruthlessness that actually I like. It's like the ruthlessness of nature. It doesn't play favorites. You know, it rains on everybody. It snows on everybody. It's cold on everybody. And then I think of this landscape. It doesn't matter when you're in that landscape if you're noble or not, unless you happen to have a fur coat as opposed to nothing.
But interesting.
There's a kind of ruthlessness to these stories that I appreciate when I hear it. I think it's accurate.
Great art's always ruthless, right?
Yeah.
Think about Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Elizabeth, Ken, Sarah, Nyazi, thank you. And thank you, Anton Chekhov. For Dreams. We've been reading from the Norton edition of Chekhov Stories. Marion Fell did our translation of Dreams. Thanks to Yo-Yo Ma for his version of the Rococo Variations composed by Chekhov's friend Tchaikovsky. Special thanks to the audio pro on so many stages, Jim Donahue, who wired us all for sound. Listeners out there, we'll be delighted to hear your take on this story and on our impressions of it. Next up, if you care to read ahead, will be Gusev, the Chekhov tale of a soldier heading home on shipboard from war in the East. Mary McGrath is producer and editor of this podcast series. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the Reading Chekhov project, and do pass it on.